world's food sources, looking at the same issue from a different perspective, the world's food sources are under pressure from climate change, population growth, and an over-reliance on a few key crops, rice, maize, and wheat among them. If one of these crops were to fail, we would be in trouble. But there is an insurance policy, thousands of wild ancestor seeds kept under lock and key to call upon when we need to find genetic resistance to a new disease or pest. Colin Currie is from the International Centre for Tropical Agriculture in Colombia, and he joins us today from Colorado. Hello, Colin.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I'm really delighted to have you on. Such an interesting area. So thank you for making time for us. Tell us first, why do we have seed banks?
An excellent and large question. We have seed banks originally 100 years ago, 150 years ago when this started. We had seed banks so that plant breeders could have genetic diversity that they could use to create new varieties of plants. Other things have happened in the last, especially the last 50 years, that have created a need for seed banks to also be centers for conservation of this diversity, as it's been lost around the world due largely to globalization.
Where are the world's major seed banks?
The seed banks are actually in just about every nation, including New Zealand and the United States, here where I am, and Colombia, where I work most of the time. There's a center of international seed banks that hold in trust for the global community, that is, the total global public, seeds of great importance for crops that are largely kind of our most basic staples. Wheat, rice, and maize, as you mentioned, as well as beans and cassava, sweet potatoes, yams, those sort of crops.
And how are the seeds stored, and how long can they last?
There's essentially two types of crops, if we want to simplify it. There's crops that can be stored as seeds themselves, and they're more or less called orthodox crops. And what's really needed is basically a freezer. You need to dry down the seeds and then condition, and they tend to last on the type of crop a couple of decades, perhaps, or even a bit longer. There's other crops that don't enjoy being frozen that way, and they need difficult techniques. One of the most common is nitrogen, which is difficult to do at first, but once they're in liquid nitrogen, they can last a very long time, hundreds of years or even longer. No one really knows because we've only been doing it for a couple of decades.
Hundreds of years or even longer, unless there's a fire or other disaster involving the seed bank, right?
Indeed. Yeah, that's actually true. And it has happened or does happen occasionally around the world, particularly in places where there's natural disasters, electricity cuts, and other sort of daily issues that can happen.
And your centre is involved in a project to measure the health of seed banks worldwide. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so there's numerous things to say there, too. Seed banks are full of very well-intentioned researchers that want to do a good job. And most of the constraints on seed banks, the difficulties come from a lack of support, of public support, generally just because the public or policymakers don't know the importance of this biological foundation of agriculture, as we call it. Of course, in places in the world that are subject to electricity outages, that's a difficulty because it doesn't take long for freezers, of course, to warm up, and then the seeds do become vulnerable quickly. And then the natural disasters, which I mentioned before, are a real issue in places like the Philippines, other areas that have typhoons, fires, as you mentioned, or, of course, civil wars, strife.
And what's happened to the diversity of crops that humans eat over, say, the past century? I've talked about that reliance on the big five. Beyond that, there's a group, I think, of 35, which provide a lot of our energy as consumed as food. But, you know, what has generally happened to the diversity of what we're eating?
Yeah, so this is a fascinating question for me particularly because if you look around at articles about the state of agriculture and how we feed ourselves, there's almost always a quote about a few crops that kind of feed us. But the quote's always a little bit different. It's, you know, some people say three crops, and some people say five, and some people say 10, and exactly how many. And I was interested in that question, and so a group of us researchers spent a couple of the last years trying to trick out kind of the definitive answer, let's say, of how many crops feed the world. And in the end, it's actually a bit of a silly question, because you can cut that question a number of ways, whether you're talking just about calories or talking about the full of our diet, which means providing for vitamin A and iron, all kinds of other things. There's many ways to argue about it. What was more important that we found out during our study was that a lot of changes happened over years. And the biggest thing that we found is that around the world, diets are becoming much more similar, and production systems around the world are becoming much more similar. That is, we're both cultivating and eating a much more similar, what we call kind of the emergence of a standard global diet around the world. And that has profound implications, because it means in much more land space around the world that we cultivate, and in many more stomachs around the world, we're relying on a set of very, very and increasingly important crops. Again, as we all know, wheat, maize, and rice. The bigger surprises were crops that are oil crops, particularly, becoming more and more important in our diets, soybean particularly, palm oil. And with all of these crops, there's issues of how they're produced, how well we're doing producing them in terms of sort of environmentally responsible way, and making sure that they're productive and resilient as they become more and more important in diets around the world.
And of the crops that we do eat, what are the major threats to them? What could happen?
Yeah, it's a great question. From my perspective, being a crop diversity specialist, I think if you asked different researchers in agriculture, they might have different answers. For instance, a soil person might say that erosion, soil erosion, would be a big issue. And I would certainly say that without knowing too much about that. What I will say is that we tend to focus on increasing yields, which is absolutely critically important. But the flip side of that is making sure that yield is sustainable over time, and that absolutely requires diversity, which again then requires conserving and having it available.
Colin, you're just dropping out a wee bit. I'll ask you to stand where you were standing at the start of the conversation if you can, or maybe that we can't do anything about that.
I can speak up, certainly.
Can you give me an example of a time in the past where a crop has run into a problem and a seed bank has provided the answer or the solution?
Yeah, certainly. Well, the best examples that we have go back even further than seed banks. The Irish potato famine, of course, is an example that we talk about, which was a genetic vulnerability of just a couple of varieties of potatoes in Ireland. And the answer was found in some genetic diversity that came from the Americas that was introduced to introduce different varieties with different genetic diversity and resistance to those pests. Another good example of the grape industry, the wine grape industry in Europe, being susceptible to soil fungus, and that, again, actually American grapes were found to have resistance in their roots that could be introduced and kind of save the European wine industry many years back.
And I read about, in The Economist, the brown plant hopper in Asia.
Uh-huh. So this is a good example of the use of a cropwild relative, as it's called, which is a wild and weedy cousin or uncle, you could say, of a crop, in this case of rice. And so this wild relative is called Oryza navara, which is a wild cousin. And that seed was collected and conserved in a seed bank, and it came from India, and researchers were able to find resistance to this pest within that wild species. And the neat thing is these wild species are closely enough related as cousins that they can be crossed with the cultivated species and introduce traits, genes, resistance without too much trouble, and produce basically a new rice that has a little bit of wildness in it that helps it be more resistant to pests and diseases.
And back, I mean, this is the early 70s, and the damage done was something over $300 million and worth more than $1 billion in today's money. So the amount of money we invest in a seed bank could easily pay off when we look at what it could save in terms of protecting us from that sort of catastrophe.
That's absolutely right. All of the financial assessments that have been made about conserving genetic diversity of crops come out with an answer that it's always worth conserving that diversity. And the other argument, of course, is that we never know exactly what we're going to need in this. And so if you keep all the pieces around is the argument. And actually, the same issue from Asia, the same pest is an example of that. Because over time, it's very, very rare that you find resistance, for instance, to a pest that lasts absolutely forever. Because it's a cat and mouse game where the pest eventually catches up and figures out how to eat the plant again. And so the plant has to find a way again to become resistant. And so as these plants become susceptible again in rice, we need to go back to these gene banks, seed banks, and look for new genetic diversity to again help the rices become resistant.
Colin Khoury from the International Center for Tropical Agriculture in Colombia. Keep up the good work, and thanks so much for sparing us some time today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.